Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor with McLean's Magazine.
The federal party leaders square off over the economy in a debate that was filled with heated exchanges and a commotion over talking points. We start off the show breaking down the key moments of the debate with a special McLean's panel, including Bureau Chief John Geddes and political editor Paul Wells.
So the debate was supposed to be about the economy, but did Canadians really hear anything new from the leaders on the economic front? To find out, we speak with economist Lindsay Tedds with the University of Victoria.
Are women's issues getting enough attention in this campaign? Well, some don't think so. So Shanna Lane decided to take matters into its own hands, holding interviews with four of the five main party leaders. I speak with the main interviewer, Katrina Onstad, about the topics discussed and what the leaders had to say.
And while people are upset about issues being ignored, we could also ask, where is the information? From scrapping the census to destroying research and records, McLean's writer Anne Kingston says Ottawa is waging a war on data. We speak with her about her cover story for this week's magazine.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. That bickering sound was heard all too often on Thursday night as the three main party leaders sparred over one of the most important issues in this election campaign, the economy. The debate was filled with heated exchanges as the leaders all tried to take down their opponents and make their economic pitch to voters.
Before we dissect the debate and listen to some key moments from the exchanges, we will point out that Green Party leader Elizabeth May was not one of the leaders on stage. However, she did take part in the debate via Twitter. May teamed up with the social media company to videotape her responses to questions and comments from other leaders, and then quickly send them out over the Twittersphere.
On the main stage, though, it was a feisty fight. To break it all down, we have a special McLean's panel with Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes and political editor Paul Wells.
All right, so we're basically going to try and break down this debate, but you guys have chosen some key moments throughout the debate that really help tell the narrative of this election and the story of the debate itself. So, Paul, we'll start off with you. We'll go to the first clip. This is a one between Harper and Trudeau. What are we going to be listening to here?
This is from the debate segment on immigration, which Justin Trudeau read to mean essentially Syrian refugees. And so this is during a part where Justin Trudeau is talking about Syrian refugees, and the Prime Minister takes exception to some stuff he's saying, and he comes back pretty hard on the question of Syrian refugees.
The fact of the matter is we have not taken away health care from immigrants and refugees. On the contrary, the only time we've removed it is where we have clearly bogus refugee claimants who have been refused and turned down. We do not offer them a better health care plan than the ordinary Canadian can receive.
I think that's something that most new and existing and old stock
Canadians agree with. On the issue of refugees, this remains one of the largest countries in the world in terms of refugee resettlement, including from Syria and Iraq.
That's not true, Mr. Harper.
I have said we will bring in more, but what I have said we will not do. You know, these guys would have had, in the last 2 weeks, us throwing open our borders and literally hundreds of thousands of people coming without any kind of security check or documentation.
That's some other not true, Mr. Harper.
That would have been an enormous mistake.
See,
we're following a balanced approach where we're bringing more refugees.
Fears, okay.
Where,
all the
where
time.
We're providing
fears
more humanitarian
of others,
support.
Fears of different communities.
And we're taking
we have a Prime Minister who prefers to pander to fears.
Paul, why is that important?
Well, the Prime Minister, I have to hope that he misspoke when he said that the other guys would have spent the last 2 weeks throwing open our borders, literally hundreds of thousands of people coming without any kind of security check. Nobody is proposing that hundreds of thousands of Syrian refugees be let into Canada. It's not a tenth of that in the most optimistic scenario. And neither is anyone, least of all Mulcair or Trudeau, talking about no security checks or documentation. The Prime Minister got a nice bump in the polls about a week ago when he took a very different tack from the other guys on Syrian refugees, much kind of more realist and less romantic tack. And that bump seems to have gone away, and he seems now almost desperate to bring it back with some frankly appalling rhetoric.
It's interesting, Paul. You're saying we hope he didn't mean that. But the truth is, just last weekend, there was this change in tone that many people noted. I happened to be at the event where he trotted out the protect our economy theme as opposed to talking about a strong, prosperous economy, talking about protecting our economy. And the whole tone that day was, it's a fearful, fearful world out there. the economy is fragile, security is in jeopardy. The tone, I mean, to say he's fear-mongering sounds harsh, but there is a strong dimension of dark foreboding in the way he likes to talk about things. And I think that we all remember the troubles of the world lapping on Canada's shores in the last campaign. This is a theme he comes back to, like reinforcing the notion that, hey, things are worrisome. You want not necessarily the guy you like the best, but the guy you trust the most to protect you, you know, in charge of the country.
So let's move on to the second clip, John. This one is about Trudeau. What is he talking about here?
Here we're getting into the big D word from the campaign, deficits. Trudeau's probably biggest risk he's taken in the campaign is declaring that he will run deficits for 3 years. That's how he's tried to differentiate himself from Tom Mulcair. And here's a clip where he gets talking about that stuff. But interestingly, more in the context of how he differentiates his deficits from Harper's deficits.
Environment can afford. Harper, you have run deficits in good years. You have run deficits in bad years. The only time you've said the deficits are not going to be run is in election years. The fact of the matter is you stood on stages like these, looked at Canadians three times, and promised not to bring in deficits. And yet, that's exactly what you've done. The reason that we're stuck in deficits for so long is because you don't understand that giving tax breaks and benefits to the wealthiest Canadians is not a way to grow the economy anymore. We have low growth. You have the worst job creation record since World War II of any prime minister. And that's what Canadians are feeling. You are disconnected from people's reality. We need, once again, to get this country investing in its own future, and that's what you haven't done for 10 years.
Let me correct the facts. We ran surpluses before we had the global financial crisis. When the global financial crisis came, everyone in the world ran deficits, and we told Canadians we would run a massive stimulus program, get it out the door quickly, sustain our economy through that period, and that it would be temporary and the deficit would fall until it was eliminated. And we've done exactly that on exactly the schedule we said we would do it, and we're now in our second year of a balanced budget.
All right, so John, what did you take from that exchange?
I thought it was interesting on a couple of fronts. There's a tricky thing that Justin Trudeau is trying to do here. He's trying to say, my deficits would be smart deficits to grow the economy in a modest way over 3 years when we need an injection of stimulus from the federal government. Mr. Harper's deficits were kind of reckless, unplanned deficits that didn't really follow some kind of economic strategy. I'm not sure you can get voters to parse what a deficit is quite that finely. So he's playing a tricky game there. But the other thing he's doing is injecting his other big theme, I would argue, from debate night, which is don't give the rich people tax breaks. He's calling for a new tax bracket for people making more than 200 grand. And here we hear him saying that he thinks the prime minister has been giving tax breaks and benefits to the wealthiest Canadians. And, you know, this was both a way to go at Harper, but I think maybe more particularly to contrast himself with Tom Mulcair on that platform last night.
Any Liberal who takes Harper to task for his deficits post-2008 runs the risk of some pretty serious intellectual incoherence.
Absolutely.
Justin Trudeau's signature appeared on the petition to the Governor General in 2008 when the Coalition tried to take over power from the Conservatives. And the premise of that was that Harper was refusing to run deficits and he needed to run some big deficits real fast. There was never a point where the Liberals since 2008 have thought that Harper wasn't cutting spending fast enough. They've always thought he was cutting spending too quickly. So that being said, you could make a good case for incurring some debt now to make investments in infrastructure. Smarter people than me have made that case.
Yeah.
But the good deficit, bad deficit dichotomy is something that people are going to have a hard time buying.
All right. So Paul, we'll go back to you for the next clip and we'll jump a little bit back into immigration. What are we going to listen to here?
Yeah, the moment was about immigration and Tom Mulcair is speaking specifically about immigration policy, but in a little riff on the theme of family reunification, he drops a line that could have come out of the mouth of Margaret Thatcher or Ronald Reagan.
Canada is a country of immigrants, unless you're First Nations, Inuit, or Métis. Your family immigrated to Canada, and it's what built this great country, David. And I couldn't be prouder than to tell you that my wife, Catherine, immigrated to Canada, and she's one of the many people who's just contributed so much, and I think we can be so proud of that tradition. Now, under Mr. Harper's Conservatives, we've been closing the door more and more on certain aspects of immigration. Mr. Trudeau just referenced it, and he's right. Family reunification is essential. It's always been part of our immigration system. It's been completely shut down under Mr. Harper's Conservatives. I personally believe that the best social program is a united family, and you've got that strong family base there allowing people to come in. Shouldn't be considered, as the Conservatives always call it, just a burden for society. I think it's something that contributes a great deal.
So what do you take from Mulcair's words?
Well, I was just so struck by that line. I personally believe that the best social program is a united family. And I note when I quoted that on Twitter last night during the debate without comment, it was widely retweeted by New Democrats, including Rebecca Blakey, who's the national president of the NDP. This is a line that the NDP wanted to have in this debate at some point. And why? Because it indicates the extent to which Mulcair is running as a moderate. He's running as the least threatening New Democrat you ever saw, if you find New Democrats threatening. When you're running against an incumbent who is widely considered to have simply ruined everything, then you run as the voice of reason. When you're running against an incumbent who still has a lot of support in the land, it's harder. You essentially have to run as a better incumbent. You can't run as the change agent. You have to run as the reassuring agent. And that's what Mulcair is doing with this talk about strong families, with his repeated guarantees that he won't ever run a deficit, things like that. That's what we see in this excerpt.
So we'll end off with a clip of what we saw a lot last night, where leaders were trying to distinguish themselves from each other. And we saw that definitely with Trudeau and Mulcair. John, what are we listening to here?
Yeah, a lot of this is some of that talk over stuff between Mulcair and Trudeau. But finally, Mulcair, you know, verbally elbows his way into enough space to make his point about how he's essentially saying that Trudeau's deficits would be leaving a burden on people. And he also manages to evoke the name of Jack Layton. Why don't we just give it a play?
Our plan is based on long-term vision. We know what has to be accomplished.
Long-term,
we are not doing like the
now,
Liberals with their short-term approach, leaving tens of billions of dollars on the backs of future generations. And you know, Mr. Trudeau, you were talking before about Stephen Harper's budgets. But you have voted for Stephen Harper's budgets. I can guarantee you I have never voted for one of his budgets. And your very first vote as a member of Parliament was to vote for his tax giveaway to Canada's largest corporations. I can guarantee you that Jack Layton and I fought that every single step of the way.
All right, so John, what do you think of that?
Couple of things stand out for me. One is just the audio reminder that the Trudeau-Mulcair sparring is so important now, so important. We all know who Stephen Harper is. We all know where he stands with Canadian voters. They have to decide how many have to, or want to vote for him. But Mulcair and Trudeau are still basically battling for much of the same turf. There's a lot of overlap in where their votes are, particularly in BC and Ontario, and they got to fight for that. And this thing of Thomas Mulcair finally getting Jack Layton's name into the mix, I think it was the only time he did in the debate, if I'm not mistaken. That also was something I was listening for, to see how it would be invoked, and there it was.
There's a lot of votes that can move from any one of these parties to any one of the others, but it's become clearer and clearer as this campaign has progressed that neither of the New Democrats or the Liberals are going to get many votes from the Conservatives.
I think that's
the Conservative
right.
vote is pretty much nailed down,
yeah.
Which means the New Democrats and the Liberals have to get their vote from each other. And that's what leads to the increasingly hot emotional tone of these exchanges between Mulcair and Trudeau.
All right, thank you very much, guys. Really appreciate it. McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes, McLean's political editor Paul Wells.
Now, that panel is actually an edited version of our discussion. The full audio will be posted in Monday's edition of the McLean's Bulldog, a daily tablet edition from McLean's, which will continue until the election is over.
Still to come on the show, we break down the debate further with an economist, we find out what the leaders had to say about women's issues, and we talk about the war on data.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor with McLean's Magazine.
Coming up on the show, Chatelaine speaks with four of the five main party leaders to discuss women's issues, and we find out why Ottawa has a war on data and what that means for you. But first,
the debate on the economy was definitely filled with political rhetoric, but did it really get to the heart of the matter when it comes to the challenges facing our economy? To find out, I spoke with Lindsay Teds, an economist and an associate professor at the University of Victoria.
As an economist watching a debate about the economy, how was it?
I found the debate to be very hard to follow in terms of the actual economics underlying the platforms. I think that too much time was spent sticking to, you know, speaking notes rather than actually talking about what the actual individual policies of each of those parties means for not just short-term economic growth, which seems to be a lot of the focus, but more importantly, what the long-term economic benefits of each of the platforms are. That never gets discussed, and that would have been really nice to hear more information about.
So we have essentially, you know, three parties, but three kind of different approaches to how they want to approach the economy. How do you sort of parse those three different approaches?
Well, I think it's important to remember with the NDP platform, while they say it's a balanced budget with potential for surplus, they based their assumption off of the budget 2015 numbers in April, which have dramatically declined since then. So I don't think there's a lot of support for the fact that they are going to have a balanced budget or even running a surplus in the first year. So I think that's important to say. So they might be a little more like the Liberals than they want to be. but in terms of over the short term, over the next 4 years, it doesn't really matter who ends up in Ottawa. The economy is going to run the same way as it's going to, because this is what we're dealing with are things that are set on the world stage. There's not a lot a politician can do about our exchange rate, not a lot they can do about the price of oil and commodities and minerals, and a trade with the manufacturing sector. So over the short term, there isn't a difference between them. But over the long term, there is. We have to be thinking about what is it that we can do today to ensure we have more growth over the future, and that growth helps insulate us from these world economic shocks that we don't have a lot of exposure to. And there, I think the Liberals are getting a lot of attention from economists because they are focusing in on investments that will help economic growth over the longer term.
You know, it's interesting. There was a survey that came out this week that asked voters about, you know, some specific policy ideas, and some of those, like, you know, raising taxes on people who earn the highest salaries and taxing corporations. Those ideas were politically popular, but my general sense from talking to economists is that they aren't exactly at the top of the sort of dream wish list of economists. How do you sort of, or do you even try to square sort of popular opinion with sort of economic fundamentals?
When it comes to corporate taxes, it looks like there's not a lot that we can do. You have a lot of people, Kevin Milligan, myself, Jack Mintz, talking to people about why we need to be very careful about raising corporate taxes. And I think if people just spent the time to think about the history of corporate taxes, the reason why we have corporate taxes is we used to not be able to tax the benefits that shareholders got from investing in corporations. However, the world has changed a great deal since then, and we have very little leakage of that money now. We can tax most of it in the hands of the people that we intended to. So as a result, there isn't a need to have high taxes because we can extract it when it gets to the people into the hands of the people that are involved within the corporation. When we tax it at the corporate level, we have no control over whether or not that is going to impact the wages of the employees, whether it's going to impact unemployment rates, and whether or not it's going to be instead funneled through to the consumer. So I think people need to be very, very careful and understand specifically what the intent of a corporate tax is. And now that we have the tools that we have to tax that money in the hands of the people that we want to tax it in, corporate taxes aren't as much of a panacea as they used to be.
And what about the tax the rich idea?
Tax the rich idea. We do want to be careful about, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, that psychological level of taxes, that once you hit sort of around the 50% marker, we really have to be thinking about the tax avoidance behaviors that high-income people are going to engage in. For example, incorporating into CCPCs and being able to shelter their money within that vehicle. And then because we do not tax the gains from the sale of shares in a Canadian-controlled private corporation, we never end up being able to tax that money. So we do have to be careful about the incentives we put in place and how people can avoid taxes on high-income people and end up, you know, not paying anywhere near their quote-unquote fair share.
The general idea of the economic debate and the debate around the economy, amongst economists, I'm not sure if there's much satisfaction with the way the debate is conducted. Do you see any way to sort of improve the discussion?
You know, I think one of the difficulties is, as an economist, I don't see anything that isn't the economy. people want to separate things, you know, the environment, it's foreign policy, and then, you know, this category of the economy. Well, everything is the economy. The economy is people. The economy is you and I and everybody engaging in our activities, and that affects everything. I consider the debate on the economy to be just the same thing as a general debate. It's too big. I think it, maybe if we had parsed it down into smaller debates, maybe focused in on tax policy, which seems to be an area that people are interested in, or on deficits versus surpluses, maybe if it was a little more constrained and confined, it would have been helpful. But in the end, it is important to have these debates, but in the end, I don't believe they change anybody's minds. I don't believe anything gets accomplished in these debates, and that's because we spend too much time on political jabs rather than sitting and actually engaging in an intellectual discussion about why that policy is what we want going forward in the long term, and how all the policies that party has all fit together.
That was Lindsay Tedds, an economist and an associate professor at the University of Victoria.
Still to come, Chatelaine talks women's issues with four of the five main party leaders, and we find out just how deep Ottawa's war on data goes. Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor with Maclean's Magazine.
Still to come on the show, we talk about the federal government's war on data. But first,
are women's issues getting the attention they deserve in this election? Many don't think so. In fact, there was supposed to be a debate to discuss the issues facing women in Canada, but since Elizabeth May from the Greens and Liberal Justin Trudeau were the only two leaders to confirm attendance, it was cancelled. But the group up for debate is not letting it die. Instead of a traditional debate, a reporter has interviewed four of the five main party leaders, with the exception of Conservative Stephen Harper, and on Monday the answers will be released so that Canadians can compare and contrast the leaders on a variety of issues.
In fact, Maclean senior writer Laura Payton will be there for the launch event in Toronto as one of the moderators taking part. The event will be streamed live by the Toronto Star and Le Devoir. But ahead of that release, Chatelaine was able to catch up with four of the five leaders, including Stephen Harper, to do its own interviews on women's issues. I was able to speak with Katrina Onstad, who interviewed three of the four leaders. What are the topics in general that you discussed with the leaders that would affect women today?
Yeah, well, you know, we always struggle with this idea of what is a women's issue, because we don't want women to seem like some kind of special interest group. There are quite a few of us. But at the same time, there are, specific sort of social circumstances that affect women. So, you know, and questions of equality and social justice. And so when we kind of filtered that bigger idea down, we kind of talked about gender parity in government, violence against women, the pay gap, and then of course as these interviews actually came to realization, we thought, well, you know, if we have Stephen Harper on the phone, a lot's happening and kind of in real time that affects women as it affects all Canadians. So we ended up talking to them about the refugee crisis, which was very much in the news while we were doing these interviews.
Well, I mean, you know, the general topics affect women just as much as anybody else. So
yeah, exactly. You know. So, I mean, it's sort of, and we're acutely aware of that, right? It's not like women just want to talk about childcare, but of course, you know, and childcare is an issue that affects everybody across the spectrum of our society. So, and yet at the same time, you know, our readers, it's something that they are really interested in. So we're trying to kind of strike that balance.
All right, now I'm just going to look at each interview individually, and specifically, I think on areas that each leader was challenged. Because if you read every interview, every leader was challenged on at least one policy or another. So with Conservative leader Stephen Harper, the topics of women's security and missing and murdered Aboriginal women came up. What did you ask about it, and what did you hear as a response?
Yeah, that was very interesting. So this is another area that we really wanted to dive into, about whether or not this was the moment for national inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women. And this is something that the UN has called for, as well as many First Nations leaders and, you know, most poignantly victims of violence. So I just asked him, you know, why not? Why won't your government do it? Because he had said earlier this year in an interview on the CBC, it's not high on our radar. And I think that phrase, you know, it really struck, I think, the people in that community. And it really was kind of a loud response. So I sort of threw that back at him, and I really wanted to know. And also, actually, for me personally, I was really curious how that set with his involvement in the apology to the First Nations of several years ago, which I think is one of the few times that we've really seen Stephen Harper's emotional side in public. So I feel like there's some kind of relationship to this issue. I had 20 minutes with him, so I couldn't get into it, but you know, I asked, and he said, "No, that's, you know, that has been studied to death, and we don't think that there's a knowledge gap here on this issue."
And he discussed as well trying to deal with the criminal aspect of it.
Yeah. So his response was really, "Well, we've enacted a lot of tough on crime measures that are keeping all the vulnerable members of our society safer," and you know, that's something that we've heard from him and from his party throughout this election, and that was his answer here.
Now, for Thomas Mulcair, the NDP leader, you took a look at his daycare promise, and that's one of the, I guess, feathers in his cap for his platform. It's one of those issues that he's very proud of, and he's been talking a lot on the campaign, promising $15 a day daycare. You took a look at that with him. What did you get there?
Yeah, well, he talked about how that policy of national child care would be an economic boon, and he used, of course, the example of Quebec, where they've had this such a program in place for a long time, and he said that every dollar that the system costs, more than a dollar will flow back into the coffers. I was kind of interested in whether or not the NDP bears any responsibility for the fact that we don't have a universal child care program, because, of course, in 2005, all of these funding agreements were in place. And this is an issue that comes up, you know, what, 30 years we've been talking about this? It never seems to happen. And in 2005, it really looked like it might. And then the coalition government dissolved, and Jack Layton was part of that dissolution, dissolving Paul Martin's minority government in 2005. So I asked him about that, and he just said, you know, well, the Liberals had 13 years to put child care in place, and they weren't thrown out on child care. They were thrown out on corruption. And he, you know, kind of brushed off the idea that maybe the NDP missed a moment there.
I found it interesting as well that the first question with Green Party leader Elizabeth May was about feminism and an issue that popped up on her platform.
Yeah, I was quite surprised by that as well. I mean, it challenges my own assumptions that, that our sole female candidate is going to be, infallible feminist figure. But yes, recently this summer, the Green Party was called to task for some rather strange language in their platform about divorce. And one of the implications was that divorce is harmful to women, and it sort of almost seemed to be saying, women need to stay in these marriages no matter how difficult they may be. So it was quite surprising, and some people dug it up, and they reacted very quickly and have since changed that language so that what they're really talking about is trying to mediate, how their party would work towards mediation in divorce proceedings so that people's finances and families can remain as healthy and as intact as possible, which seems very reasonable. But to hear her called out for not being enough of a feminist, she obviously was immediately quite defensive and said, we are a feminist party and we follow feminist tenets and principles, and we have looked at that part of our platform very carefully, and let's move on.
Okay, so the last leader that there was an interview with that we haven't touched on here is Liberal leader Justin Trudeau. Now, you did not do that interview. You did the three other interviews that we just discussed. But can you tell me what Trudeau's responses were in that interview, and particularly around the challenge of his support for Bill C-51?
Yeah, I didn't. Rachel Giza did this interview. Of course, I've read it. And she, confronted him about the anti-terrorism legislation, Bill C-51, and how it doesn't, expand oversight to protect civil liberties. And he just talked about, the challenges of striking a balance between security and liberty. And he also said, she said, well, that's, it's cost you in the polls, because this hasn't been a very popular position. It's been, I think, for some people left of center, a surprising position to see the Liberals take. And he said it wasn't a difficult position for them, that he didn't have to whip his caucus on C-51, that they had a long conversation over this, and there's unity in the party, and that they've worked hard to improve that piece of legislation, and that it's basically not as bad as it was before the Liberals took a whack at it.
And how can people read the full interviews with all of the leaders? Is it only going to be online, or will you have it in the magazine as well?
Yeah, it's online right now. So chatelaine.com, you can find them, and then there will be a print version as well in the next issue of the magazine. They'll be slightly more truncated than they are online. So please pick it up.
That was Katrina Onstad with Chatelaine, who interviewed federal party leaders about women's issues.
Coming up after the break, why is Ottawa destroying so much data?
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor with McLean's Magazine.
First, it was the census. Then the government started pulling old reports off the internet and shutting down research libraries within its own departments. There's been a steady erosion of government information available to Canadians, and it's affecting the country's economy, among many other things.
McLean's Magazine's Anne Kingston looks at the disappearing data in her piece, Vanishing Canada, which is the cover story for this week's issue of McLean's. Our senior writer, Laura Payton, also spoke to her about her article.
We've heard a lot about the Conservatives killing the long-form census, but you wrote about a lot of other examples of how information in Canada is vanishing. Can you please tell me a little bit about that?
Well, I think you're right. The long-form census is something we focused on, and I think some of the themes that emerged from the loss of the long-form census, for instance, statistical ghost towns, are echoed in the ghostliness of statistics more generally and how they're collected. For instance, I looked across the spectrum. I looked at the Libraries Archives Canada. I looked at the loss of scientific research, which has been well chronicled, but certain aspects haven't been as investigated. I also looked at Stats Canada more generally in terms of the way trends in terms of statistics gathering, and which were very concerning. So it was a pretty encompassing look at information gathering and also information dissemination in terms of access to information itself from the government.
Some of it was related to budget cuts, but you wrote about how it might not be the smartest economic choice. What did you find when you looked at that?
Well, there's a litany of examples of just how things that were cut under the austerity regime are in fact short-sighted economically. The census is a classic example of that in terms of, you know, the effect, for one thing, on business itself. Let's not even talk about the Canadian economy, but businesses and industry have been hugely hampered by the failure to collect certain information that's necessary to start up business, to market, etc., right across the board. The census also provided just, you know, requirements for smart policy making, so the government didn't waste money. So it was really an example of the penny-wise, you know, pound-foolish thinking.
And what do these kinds of cuts mean for people who might not necessarily go to Statistics Canada, or they might not necessarily, refer to the census for a study?
Well, as I mentioned, I think it affects, there's a ripple effect in lots of ways. It affects the ability to gather information that creates policy that affects all Canadians, for one thing. It affects the art scene. That was what struck me when I did the piece. At the beginning, I didn't really realize how embracing, how all-encompassing the loss of information was. It affects every facet of the economy. We tend to focus on the effect of on democracies and parliamentary processes, but we really don't talk about how it affects the arts or economists trying to figure out. For instance, one example I give is the current oil price crisis. We can't even look back to the 1970s because that data isn't available to see trends that happened then. We can't forecast because we can't look back.
And in fact, we're losing, or government scientists and departments are losing libraries.
At a rapid speed. In fact, when I was doing the piece, I had to keep updating. It was a long-term study, and as it was unfolding, there was sort of something new. And also trying to just parse what was true was really difficult because you had scientists, you know, claiming, making one statement and the government saying, no, we're not actually losing. There was an example recently in Alberta of an agriculture library was closed down, and the government was saying, well, that data will be available digitally. And digitalization is another big thing that I looked into. And scientists were saying, sorry, a lot of the raw data is not available, the books, the sorts of things that we really need. So there's these dueling kind of narratives going on as well, and it's very difficult to figure out what is actually true.
Now, the reason given for ending the long-form census was privacy concerns. But you compared that to a couple of recent pieces of legislation that this same government has passed. Tell me about that.
Well, I think, yes, privacy was given as a reason to end the census, and I think that's been pretty disabused. I interviewed Munir Sikh, who actually ended up quitting in the wake of that, of the cutting of the census, and he absolutely poo-pooed that notion that it had anything to do with privacy. It complied with privacy requirements. I think that when you actually look at what information is being lost, and also we're looking at one of the kind of seesaws in the piece that emerged as I was researching. It was the fact that you have this kind of paradox. On one hand, Canadians are losing the ability to look at themselves clearly through statistics and other means. At the very same time, the government is gaining unprecedented access to personal information about citizens, so that you have this idea that privacy, individual privacy, is certainly is being invaded at a time the government is using privacy concerns as a reason not to let Canadians look at the collection of data about the nation itself and the way government is functioning.
Now, you wrote that all of the opposition parties have pledged to reinstate the long-form census if they win government. But would that make up for the loss of it over 4 years, even if one of those parties does win the election?
Well, there will be black holes, for sure, as a result. But that wouldn't be, I don't think, a reason not to reinstate it. There is data that we will never know. We will not know certain things about smaller Canadian communities as of 2011. That's a price that we are going to have to pay for this. That will never be erased or recovered, is a better way of putting it.
Okay. How are people reacting around the world to these kinds of losses?
Well, what was interesting is, again, I mean, looking at sort of going back to your question about the economic prudence of some of these measures, one of the things that it has done is it's impeded our competitiveness. And in talking to statisticians internationally, they were shocked at, first of all, the political motivation of losing the census, and also pointed out that Canada is now being used as a cautionary tale internationally, and you know the consequences of the costs of having lost the increased costs that we're now paying to gather less information is being used in the United States, for instance, where the Republicans are calling for the loss of their collection of data, which is different than Canadians, but the equivalent of our long-form census, and people are pointing north and saying, look at what happened there. We do not want to go down that route.
You also write about something that journalists have long complained about, and I think a lot of people don't really, might not see the pertinence in their lives, but the access to information laws and how some people have had to turn to access to information to try and get some of the records that they might normally not have needed it for. How is that working for them?
Well, I think that's a really interesting area, actually. And one of the things I found, and it's not in the piece, but individuals now comprise the greatest percentage of, you know, people going, a group, rather, of people, you know, using access to information, which is pretty fascinating. Usually we think of the media or government itself using it as a means to get information, but the public is using it. Now, exactly why that's happening isn't clear, but we're starting to see, I think people are really aware of big profile cases. I talk about a few of them in which this information is just being blocked and at huge cost, and we don't see how government is being run. So I think on an individual level, the sort of, as you say, the kind of frustration felt within the media is percolating in a broader kind of atmosphere.
You've clearly spent The research in this is quite deep. What is your takeaway after spending all of this time looking at this whole range of lost sources of information?
Well, I mean, as a Canadian, I felt, and as a journalist, I felt very disheartened and concerned, I have to say. I didn't really realize how pervasive and insidious the loss of information, just how broadly it's not simply what's lost, it's what it's being replaced with. And people are no longer the source of information. Industry, for instance, is increasingly the source of information, and we're going to pay a price for that. So I think, I guess I really didn't realize how interconnected all of this information was. It's not, we tend to think of it in silos as in terms of the arts or science, but it's all incredibly interconnected, and it's a weakening of the social fabric as a result. So I guess my takeaway is one of concern and a bit of alarm that we really need to look at this and figure out how we're going to fix the problem.
All right. Anne Kingston, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was McLean senior writer Laura Payton speaking with Anne Kingston about the disappearing data in the federal government.
Now, if you want to read Anne's piece, you can pick up the latest issue of Maclean's magazine or head to Maclean's.ca.
That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.